Sowing season is here. What seeds will you be sowing? Maybe vegetables, herbs, flowers, cover crops, microgreens, or seeds for sprouting? Well, whatever kind of seed you are after, True Leaf Market has you covered. True Leaf Market's been supplying superb seed since 1974. And you can expect swift delivery and a fantastic choice of crops to grow. Check out trueleafmarket.com for a superb selection of seeds, plus tons of free advice, including their downloadable guides to microgreens, herb growing, and more. You can get $10 off at trueleafmarket.com now when you spend $50 using code ONTHELEDGE10. That's $10 off with code ONTHELEDGE10. Welcome to On The Ledge podcast, and this week I bring you a splendour of succulents and cacti. I'm your host, Jane Perrone, and in this week's show, I'm talking to author Caroline Ball about a groundbreaking book that brought succulents to life in the 18th century. Correction from last week's Q&A episode, episode 258. Lots of you said you enjoyed the show, but thank you to Kev's Orchids for pointing out that I made a boo-boo. I'm always happy to own up to my mistakes, and in this case, the question from the Happy Plotter, which I said concerned a calathea, actually concerned a caladium. Now, interestingly, the advice I gave, I'd pretty much keep the same, whether it was a caladium or a calathea. Of course, caladiums generally do die down in the autumn in sort of my kind of climate, and probably any kind of indoor climate where the light levels drop in the winter. Caladiums tend to die back to nothing and then regrow from their bulb. Calatheas, on the other hand, or to correctly give them their up-to-date genus name, Gepertias, don't tend to do that unless they're really, really unhappy. And they tend to grow back from their rhizomes, which are another form of storage organ. They're a sort of a special form of stem. So it's a slightly different mechanism, but the same things apply in terms of giving the plant some support with a clear plastic bag and putting it somewhere warm and bright, but not in direct light. So I'm sorry that I messed that up, the Happy Plotter. And I'm hoping to do a caladium episode at some point with an expert on caladium. So watch this space. Maybe we'll do more on those soon. Also, an On The Ledge sew along update. I'm going to do an Instagram live at lunchtime on the 22nd of March 2023. My Instagram is j.l.perrone, and I'm going to do an Instagram live about half an hour from 1 o'clock on the 22nd of March, that's UK time, talking about all of the issues to do with sowing seeds, and I'll probably actually do a little bit of seed sowing live as well and be there to answer your questions. So do pop along to that if you can for more seed sowing goodness. Thank you to Ian for becoming a super fan and Chris for becoming a legend, joining the ranks of the Patreon clans. And you can do the same, just visit janeperrone.com for all the details. It's tempting to think that the current clamour for cacti and succulents is a very new thing, and that we're all very innovative and different for deciding to get into these plants. But if history tells us anything, is that there ain't nothing new out there, really, is there? And that is very true with our current succulentomania, as we might call it. And that's why I was keen to talk to author Caroline Ball about her new book, A Splendour of Succulents and Cacti, which uncovers the 18th century's passion for succulent plants via a groundbreaking book that included magnificent colour illustrations of beautiful plants from around the world, including many cacti and succulents. Here's Caroline to tell us more.
My name is Caroline Ball, and I'm the author of some books about plants, and this one is slightly different. It's called A Splendour of Succulents and Cacti, and I should say right from the off, it's not an encyclopedia of succulents or how to look after them, but it's rather a celebration of a rare book of plants that was published nearly 300 years ago.
I've got it in front of me, Caroline. Welcome to the show, by the way. And it really is a splendour of succulents and cacti. I do love these illustrations. And we're going to get into the origins of these and how it all came about as we talk. It is fascinating to see that those of us who perhaps are new to the hobby of succulents think that succulents are a very new fascination, but this book tells a very different story about our love for succulents and how far back it goes. How far back can we trace the origins of this succulentomania, as you call it in the book?
Well, you could say it's as old as civilization itself. The ancient Egyptians, for example, used certain aloes for medicinal purposes and as beauty preparations. And the Mayans and Aztecs, they used lots of different succulents because so many, something like 60% of cacti originate in Mexico. So they had lots on their hands. But the first big explosion of interest in Europe can be put down to Christopher Columbus. One of Columbus's tasks, as well as discovering and claiming new lands for the Spanish monarchs, of course, he was asked to seek out and bring back anything that was interesting and useful, gold and silver, naturally, but also anything, any curiosities, and also plants. Now, we all know about tomatoes and potatoes and chocolate, which Europeans had no idea existed. But one of the particular plants they did know about and requested particularly was aloes. That jelly-like pulp inside their leaves and stems was always in high demand for all kinds of conditions, to treat skin complaints and gum disease and even battle wounds. And the Spanish king and queen, Ferdinand and Isabella, hoped they might, through Columbus, secure a supply of their own from this as yet undiscovered new world they had such high hopes for, rather than have to rely on traders from Africa and Asia. And sure enough, Columbus did find a great number of new aloes, or at least that's aloes in inverted commas, because they're mostly what we would now call agaves. But he also came across some other succulents that must have struck him and his fellow explorers as really weird. And these were the cacti. We imagine, because they look so at home in dry lands all over the world, that they must always have been there. But cacti are only native to the Americas. Actually, I must qualify that because there's bound to be an expert out there who'll pick me up on it. There is one cactus called Ripsalis bacifera, the mistletoe cactus, which is believed to be native to Asia and Africa. But these early Spanish and Portuguese conquistadors would never have seen anything like a prickly pear or a giant saguaro or great round barrel cactus. And they must have been absolutely astonished. And so a whole range of extraordinary, never before seen plants began to be shipped across the Atlantic to Europe. So I guess that could be what would be called the first mania for succulents.
I guess the unwritten side of this that we really don't know is how the indigenous peoples of places like Mexico felt about their cacti and succulents being ripped out of the ground and taken to Europe. It's been happening for since these times, but you can see why these plants were appealing to Western sensibilities. They were new, they were unusual, they were architectural, and they were useful as well. I guess that all of those things applied. And looking through the illustrations in the book, what amazed me was quite how accurate the portrayals were. Were they changing hands for large amounts of money when they first arrived?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the aloes we've talked about, so they would have been very keen. Any one involved in medicine or apothecaries, people like that, were always thirsty for new plants to try out on their poor patients. I've mentioned the aloes, but a popular treatment for many illnesses was to purge the patient, to make them vomit or empty their bowels. And succulent members of the huge euphorbium family were very effective for purging, which is why, by the way, that the common name for a lot of euphorbias is spurge, purge, spurge. So probably a lot of people will have heard of John Gerard and his herbal, which came out at the end of the 16th century. And he mentions prickly pears or puntias. He called them prickly Indian figs. And he mentions that they turn your urine to the colour of blood. Not really very clear whether this was a good thing or a bad thing, but it's indicative of indeed. It's indicative of the sort of interest that these new plants piqued in people like that. You said about the extreme value. Obviously, there were people who were collecting them. I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. But prickly pears in particular were the source of something that turned out to be extraordinarily valuable. And they had no idea. Because when those early explorers that we were talking about, when they came in contact with the Aztecs, they was amazed by the Aztecs, as I'm sure the Aztecs were amazed by these strange people who were arriving on their shores. And we won't go into the history of what happened, but the conquest was not a happy one. They were looking primarily for silver and gold, El Dorado and all that. But one thing that they noticed is that the Aztecs, in their paintings and in the fabrics that they wove for their clothes, one of the colours they had was an extraordinarily bright scarlet. And Europeans at the time were using plants such as madder or minerals like cinnabar to make their red pigments, but they were nowhere near as brilliant as what the Aztecs could get. And the Spanish rightly predicted that Europe would go wild for this new colour if only they could find out how the Aztecs made it. And this is something that the Aztecs did keep to themselves to begin with, but eventually the Spanish discovered the source. And it was an insignificant looking little insect that lived and bred on prickly pears. And the Spanish called it cochinillo, cochinillo. And so by the middle of the 16th century, these little insects were the most valuable import from the Americas after gold and silver. And the Spanish managed to keep their monopoly on it for more than 200 years, which is pretty impressive. But inevitably, eventually, the Brits and the French and the Dutch and so on found their own sources. And prickly pears and cochineals go on to have their own interesting history in quite different parts of the world. But to keep on track about this early fascination with these first new arrivals, as you picked up on, people wanted to collect them. So they were prized for their looks. And as you said, the paintings in the book are very detailed, and we'll come on to how they were done and everything. But the aloes in particular are presented rather beautifully in their fancy, colourful urns that they're potted up in. They're not made to look like wild plants at all. And that's how they would have been displayed by collectors. And perhaps surprisingly, some of the most enthusiastic collectors were in Northern Europe, where the cool, damp climate is quite the opposite of what most succulents like. But I don't know, maybe that's exactly why. There's nothing like a challenge or a scarcity of something to make it covetable and a must-have.
Yeah, you're right. Some of these containers are, I mean, I might even describe them that they're very jolly, and some of them I would even say are bordering on gaudy. They're some quite elaborate. I mean, there's a few which are kind of more simple, just look like sort of half oak barrels, but then there's some which have really gone for the whole, you know, pink and gold scrolls and ruffles look. I mean, it must have been made these plants look even more dramatic. I mean, I guess, and also was just showing off the wealth of the owner, I'm assuming, along with the valuable plant. They've got a valuable pot to go with it.
That's definitely the case, because this wasn't your average Joe living in an ordinary street who could afford these. The biggest collectors were the aristocracy. We all know the story about, you know, pineapple pits and things like that being grown. And it was all about saying how wealthy, how grand I am that I've been able to produce this exotic plant. And yes, the pots were all part of that look. But rather nicely, we can see one of those collections today, if you happen to be in the vicinity of London, because of the collection that Mary II made. Mary was the daughter of James II, that's James VII for all those Scots out there, and her interest in plants probably began at an early age because her tutor was an enthusiastic botanist who later became the Bishop of London. And then she was married off to Prince William of Orange and, of course, moved to the Netherlands. And she would have come across a great many more plants that were new to her there, because William was also interested in botany and plants. And the Dutch at the time had extensive territories from the Dutch East Indies and Malacca, bits of India and Southern Africa, and then right across to the Caribbean and the coast of South America. Then when she and William came to England, they were asked to become joint monarchs in 1688, they brought with them what Mary called her tender exotics. And they were kept in special early glass houses and orangeries at the Royal Palace at Hampton Court. There's one section of the gardens which was known as the Glass Case Garden, and it had three hothouses, and each of them, these make our greenhouses seem very pathetic, each hothouse was 55 foot long, that's over 16 metres. And very sadly, Mary died when she was very young, she was only 32. But the collection that she and William as well made was really one of the best in the world, and it continued to be treasured by the royals who came after them. And when George III decided to live at Kew Palace rather than Hampton Court, he had the plants all moved there. And in time, her exotic garden became one of the foundations of what's now world-famous Kew Botanical Gardens. And have you been to Hampton Court Palace recently, Jane?
I have for the flower show, but I didn't get a chance to look at the gardens. And I haven't really been to the gardens part since I was probably a child, which is a long time ago. I remember getting very lost in the maze.
Right. Well, next time you go, avoid the maze and head for the Queen's Garden, because for, oh, goodness, 30 years, I think, the garden team there have been researching Mary's original collection. So you can now visit what they've recreated. There are lots of orange trees, for William and Mary of Orange, of course, but also lots of the succulents that she had. And in the summer, they put them all displayed outside in replicas of the decorative pots that she would have used. There's lots of Delft type blue and white, as you can imagine, but just the sort of pots that had been depicted in the book that the illustrations came from.
Oh, well, that is definitely going on the garden visit list in that case. That's interesting. And I didn't realise that that was the foundation, that collection sort of was the foundation of Kew, which is also really interesting. And there was one particular succulent that you talk about in the book, which is still going today, a cordiciform plant, one of these kind of fat plants that's still going and alive today, although I suspect it's possibly past its best. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Oh, you're thinking of, this is such a sweet story, I think, though you spoiled the ending, you realise.
Apologies.
Mary,
spoiler alert.
the Austrian emperors were also great collectors. And by the 18th century, the Imperial Palace Gardens in Vienna had an amazing reputation for the plants they contained. And right at the end of the 18th century, they received this really odd-looking plant from South Africa. It, as you say, it was a type of caducifolium, which is they're those succulents that store water in their trunks. So they usually have quite an odd look about them. But this was only small, it wasn't tree size. And nobody had seen anything like it. And it was just kept as a curiosity. In fact, for quite a while, it was believed not even to be a living plant. They thought it was a fossil. And it was only in the beginning of the 20th century that it was finally identified. And it's a Phocaea crispa. And it lived on and on. And during the Second World War, a caring gardener was worried about threats from bomb raids. So he took it home with him and it spent some time on his windowsill. Now, I've called it this plant, but actually I should probably say she, because she's come to be known as the Alte Frau von Schönbrunn, the old lady of Schönbrunn. And if you visit Schönbrunn, which is the enormous former palace in Vienna, she lives in the Wüstenhaus, the desert house, and they reckon she's probably the oldest potted plant in the world.
Wow, that really is a venerable plant. And I mean, I'm fascinated by that. You always think, gosh, how can a plant live that long? It's just, that's just an amazing thing. Maybe there's descendants of other plants, presumably, that were brought over, that their descendants are still alive, that we're enjoying in our many of our European botanical gardens as well. But for one plant to be still alive that was in its original form, is that's mind-blowing.
I think it was quite old when it arrived in Vienna.
Right, wow. More from Caroline shortly, and in next week's podcast, I will have botanist Scott Zoner on the show to talk about this issue of how long do plants live. And if you're a Patreon subscriber, you can hear an extended interview with Scott on this subject, which will be going up in the next few days. But now it's time to bring you another fact from my book Legends of the Leaf, coming out on April the 27th. And it's getting close, it's getting exciting. Unfortunately, I do have some not so exciting news related to the book. This is a bit of a gut punch, to be honest, not going to lie. I have learnt in the last week that the book is not going to be distributed in the US. So that means that you won't be seeing the physical print copy on Amazon.com or other big book selling websites. You will be able to get hold of the book. You will be able to go into a bookshop and order a copy, and you'll be able to download the ebook, I guess it's a Kindle version or the electronic form of the book, but you won't be able to get the physical book in an Amazon order or Barnes & Noble or anywhere like that. This does not affect anybody who has pledged through the crowdfunder. You will get your copies that you have bought and any other rewards that you've bought with no problem. And the book is available on amazon.co.uk, and you could order that from anywhere in the world, provided you're prepared to pay the shipping costs. This may change. The book may be picked up for distribution in the US, but currently that isn't the case. And I know how disappointing that will be for a lot of people who hope to pick the book up that way. And I'm really disappointed too, because I know that there are so many listeners in the USA who want to get their hands on this book. On the plus side, if you're in Europe, I have seen that it's available on various European book websites. And I'm putting together for my website, janeperrone.com, a list of all the places where you can get hold of the book, which will be coming very soon. So you can hopefully track it down. So there we go. As always, moving onwards and upwards. And this week's fact concerns lithops, the living stones, those incredible succulents. And their seed pods. Now, if you have ever played the game Trivial Pursuit, picture the game counter, that round pie-like structure with separate sections for each of the slices that you get every time you get the question right. Well, that's what a Lithops seed pod looks like. It has 5 to 8 little slots arranged in a pie structure, and each one has its own lid that can work independently of all the other lids. And this is shut while it's dry, but as soon as rain falls, then the lid starts to open. Raindrops can splash in and boom, the seed heads out into the world, is exposed to the rain, flooded out of that chamber, goes onto the ground, and where it finds somewhere to germinate, off it goes. That is a new Lithops plant on the way. But the plant doesn't want to waste any seed. So if some seed get stuck inside their chamber, then once the rain stops and things dry out, then the lid shuts down, dries out, the seeds left inside, and next time it rains will be available again to make a break for freedom. Isn't that cool? And that's how this plant reproduces itself. It doesn't want to waste those precious seeds. So it's a very, very, very clever little plant. More fascinating facts about Lithops in the Living Stones chapter. You can find out what rubrications are and the role of tannins in this particular species. I hope that sounds intriguing. You can find out more in the Lithops chapter of Legends of the Leaf. Now back to my interview with Caroline. Now we need to talk about the main character in all of this, the man who made all this wonderful splendour of succulents happen and presumably banked the whole enterprise as well. Can you tell me about this chap, Johan?
Yes, you're on very familiar terms with him, aren't you?
Well, it's probably because I'm looking at his second name and thinking my German is just not... I mean, I don't know how you pronounce... Is it Weinmann, I'm guessing?
That's exactly right, yes.
Okay, good. Yes. Well, I shouldn't have doubted myself, clearly, but I knew how to pronounce Johann, so... But I'm glad that I managed... My German listeners are head in hands at this point. Anyway, let's hear about Weinmann.
Right, well, yes, his full name was Johann Wilhelm Weinmann. And he was a German apothecary. He was born in 1683 and he settled as a young man in Regensburg, which is on the banks of the Danube, down in Bavaria, right in the south of Germany. And he was obviously a pretty talented businessman because he built up a thriving business from what had been a failing apothecary's shop. And by the time he was about 40, he had plenty of money to invest in his other interests, which were mostly plant related. He created a botanical garden for the city and he wrote several learned papers. And then he had this idea for his legacy, I guess, if you wish. His idea was that he would commission expert plantsmen and artists to write and illustrate a reference book. It's a sort of half herbal, half florilegium that would describe every plant in the world, with detailed descriptions of how and where they grew and distinguishing features to help with ID and the uses they could be put to. And it's the illustrations that would be what we might call today a USP, unique selling point. And by this time, early 18th century, in printing history, etchings had replaced the cruder woodcuts that the old herbals used, but they generally had to be hand-coloured. But Weinmann wanted his printed in colour. It wasn't absolutely the first book to feature colour printing, but it was one of the first and definitely one of the most ambitious. It grew and grew, and in fact, it wasn't finished until 3 years after Weinmann himself had died. And it extended to 4 big fat volumes and features around 3,500 different plants. And you mentioned the back rolling. Well, as you can imagine, it was a wildly expensive project, and only 600 copies of the book were ever printed. And in the, what, 280, nearly 300 years since it first appeared. Many of these volumes have been broken up and the prints are sold individually because they're still very popular, and you often see them popping up at auctions or for sale online. But a complete volume is extremely rare and sought after. And all the illustrations of succulents in my book have been reproduced from the editions of Vineman's book that's held in the Bodleian Library in Oxford. You were stumbling over German. We're both going to stumble over something now. You and I have both avoided saying the title of Vineman's book.
Yes.
It's just such a tongue twister. I'm going to say it now, get it out the way. It's called Phytanthosa Iconographia, but I think it's just easier to call it the Iconographia or Vineman's book, don't you?
Absolutely. I mean, perhaps back in the day, the complexity of the title was a reflection of some kind of value. I don't know why they gave it that title, but
it's something he made up. It wasn't a well-known thing. All it means is a picture book of plants, really. But as was very common, when I say the title was, here we go again, Phytanthosa Iconographia, that's only the first two words because the title page goes on and on, the whole page of it. But that was a very common thing in those days, and books would just be known by a shortened version. But we don't even like the shortened version, do we?
No, indeed. I think we need to also get in a little bit deeper into this idea of herbals and florilegiums. As you've already mentioned, you've mentioned Gerard's herbal and this idea of these key texts. Was there an actual tangible difference between a herbal and a florilegium? And do botanists still refer to these kind of documents today?
Oh, there was a definite difference, yes. They're both types of plant books, but they had different aims in mind. Herbals were primarily about how to use the plants, and they were a pretty vital reference for identifying them and differentiating between similar looking species and advising on how they should be prepared and used. And in their time, they were the go-to book for apothecaries and the like, but also a standard in most households, at least households that could read, because they advised on herbs for cooking and for strewing on the floor and how to prepare dyes from plants, as well as things like home remedies. And a florilegium was more a record of a plant collection. And so the focus was on beauty rather than utility. And it might simply be a selection of exquisite paintings of exotic flowers, or it might provide a record of all the plants in a genus or those found in a particular area or even in a particular garden. And yes, we don't really use herbals today because science has moved on, but florilegia are still produced and are very beautiful. And your English listeners may have heard about the Highgrove florilegium, which King Charles commissioned as a record of all the plants in the gardens of his Gloucestershire home when he was Prince of Wales.
Yes, of course. That, I hadn't thought of that, but that's very true. Yeah, fascinating stuff. Focusing, though, on Vineman in particular and his, I'm not going to say the title. There's some amazing images in this book. What are some of your favourites and the most interesting ones in the work? And who actually was behind these? I'm guessing he wasn't taking up a paintbrush himself. Who actually did the illustrations for the book?
Well, the short answer is no one knows. That's not quite true. Once he'd formulated the plan for his grand book, he began to collect suitable images. But then quite early on, he happened to encounter a jobbing gardener who, because he'd shown an interest in drawing and a talent for it, he'd also had some training in botanical illustration. And when Vineman discussed the project with him and showed him the paintings he'd amassed so far, this young man, because he was only 20, but he must have had huge self-confidence, because he turned around to Vineman and said, in effect, "Oh, no, it'd be much better if I did them for you, sir." So they came to an agreement, and this young man set to work. But there's no way he could ever achieve the rate of output that Weinmann wanted. And after a year, he'd only done about 500 paintings. And so they fell out and went their own separate ways. Well, we do know the name of this young artist because it was Georg Dionysius Ehret. And if you float his name in front of anyone who's got an interest in botanical art, you'll probably get a really enthusiastic response. I mean, to some, he's on a par with Redoute, who did all those wonderful roses. And Ehret went on to work and learn from the very best. He collaborated with Linnaeus, who was at the time same sort of age that the two of them. And Linnaeus was just formulating that new system, the Linnaean system for classifying plants. And Ehret then came and settled in England, where he became a highly sought after artist and also a tutor to the wealthy and titled. So after they'd broken up, Weinmann commissioned other artists. And it was quite common in those days. The original illustrators, they remained anonymous. They were never credited. And it was the engravers who translated their work onto the copper plates for printing and did the final colouring. We know their names, but we don't know the original artists who painted them.
That's a bit of a shame, isn't it, that those names kind of were in obscurity. I think hopefully times have changed now, but the work that they did, I mean, it's just so... I mean, each one of those pictures must have taken such a long time and required such amazing observation and skills. It's, as I say, it's a tragedy. We don't know all of those names. But are there any particular images that the book from the book that are your absolute favourite ones that you always sort of turn back to or maybe have framed on a wall?
If only. Well,
maybe a copy.
Well, I'm sure everyone will have their own favourites. And it's been interesting showing them to different people, different ones that have been picked out. And some of the most beautiful, you'll probably agree, are the flowers, like the night flowering cereus. But I know that the publisher is particularly fond of all those aloes because of their great urns that we've already talked about. But the ones that fascinated me in a horrifying sort of way are the Medusa's heads. They're a type of euphorbia, but completely different from the ones we might grow in our gardens. And their common name says it all, really. They look like a tangle of writhing snakes. But there's actually one other I would like to tell you about. It's another euphorbium. And at first glance, it looks like a very ordinary chunky green succulent with spines all along its edge. But what singles it out is that it's actually fictitious. I'm sure that Weinmann, yes, I know, I'm sure Weinmann had no idea about it, and he gives it a proper old-fashioned Latin name and so on. But Gordon Rowley, who only died a few years ago, he lived until his late 90s, and I'm sure some of your listeners will have come across his many books, he spotted it, and he describes the page on which it appears in the Iconographia as two genuine euphorbias and a mythical one. And so how that came to slip in, it might have been an artist who got carried away, or perhaps who was working from a misleading description, because although many of the plants in Weinmann's book were painted from life, others were copied from illustrations, or sometimes they just relied on descriptions. And I don't know if you know, there's a companion book to this, which I also did, which came out about 18 months ago, that in a different theme, it's called A Cornucopia of Fruit and Vegetables. And in it, there's a banana, and it's pretty obvious the artist has never seen a real banana.
Well, yeah, that kind of gives it away, doesn't it? He's looking at it going, is really? That's one of, I'm going to have to look that up. That's fascinating. Well, perhaps you could provide us with an image for the show notes, because I think we all want to see how they misinterpreted that.
Okay, I'll do that.
Fantastic. I mean, obviously, Rowley's reaction was being able to identify the mythical succulent. Do you think there's anything that us modern succulent enthusiasts can learn from looking at this work?
Oh, I'm sure, yes. I mean, anyone interested in botanical art will really enjoy them, I think, because they are so seldom seen, because they're mostly locked away in the bowels of august institutions like Kew Gardens and the university libraries. But from us non-botanical artists, I think of it, everything that I've learnt through it and through the research, I think of it as a little bit like travelling. We can visit a foreign city and enjoy looking at the buildings, the parks, the people, but we can gain so much more if we know a little bit about what's made that city and those people. I mean, maybe it's just me, but I think it adds something to know that, say, although cotyledons are now grown for their pretty foliage and delicate flowers, they were once used for calming upset stomachs and getting rid of kidney stones. Or that, back to prickly pears again, they rampant everywhere, warm and sunny, but they've also got little miniature relations who live in the Canadian Rockies, but they're only a few tiny little 3 or 4 inches tall. And I don't know, I just get some pleasure when I see, for instance, a barrel cactus, to know that when they first arrived in England, they were called hedgehog thistles.
Oh, that's great. Yes, I love that. I suppose we're trying to relate something that feels so strange to something familiar.
You can see why they call them hedgehog thistles, can't you?
Absolutely.
And also the sort of then and now thing, because I think it can be quite a surprise that so many of the succulents we know today were studied and collected and fated back in the 18th century. I mean, maybe it's a bit like when children realise their grandparents must have had sex.
yes, that's a good analogy. Yes, you're absolutely right. We tend to think these things have very short histories, whereas in fact, as your book so eloquently illustrates, these things go back an awfully long way. Well, I'm going to put the full details of the book in the show notes, along with some images from the book, Caroline. It's a wonderful thing, and really nice to take the opportunity to look beyond the usual and very useful advice about how to grow cacti and succulents, to actually consider their history. So thank you so much for joining me today. I hope lots of readers will be dipping into your book soon.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure and great fun to talk to you.
Thanks so much to Caroline. And if you want to see some of those illustrations from the book, do check out my show notes at janeperrone.com, where you'll also find full details of the book, its title, and where you can get hold of a copy for yourself. Thank you so much for joining me this week, and I'll be back next week with another plant-packed episode. Bye. The music you heard in this episode was Roll Jordan Roll by The Joy Drops, The Road We Used to Travel When We Were Kids by Komiku, and Whistle by Benjamin Banger. The ad music is Candlelight by Jazar. All tracks are licensed under Creative Commons. Visit the show notes for details.